in both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We have two interviews, one brand new, one recorded and broadcast originally back in 2003 to celebrate this last day of Black History Month.
Our focus for the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show is an incredibly powerful and poignant book titled They Got Daddy, One Family's Reckoning with Racism and Faith. Much of this story stems from an experience of the author's grandfather, the author Sharon Tubbs, her grandfather Israel Page, who was a preacher in rural Alabama, who unfortunately was kidnapped and severely beaten by white supremacists in an ugly incident that occurred back in 1959. The legacy of that had ramifications for years after and reverberated through the whole family, and yet it was something not very much talked about. Sharon Tubbs, who at the time was a journalist, took it upon herself to explore the story of what happened to her grandfather and, in a sense, to the rest of the family in subsequent years. And the result is this very, very powerful book that has just been released, again titled They Got Daddy, One Family's Reckoning with Racism and Faith. And I'm so happy to be able to speak with the author, Sharon Tubbs, whose work as a journalist took her on a number of different beats and for various papers, including the Tampa Bay Times and the Philadelphia Inquiry. She is a freelance writer now and busy motivational speaker, and also the director of a nonprofit organization serving underprivileged residents in Fort Wayne, Indiana. And we have Sharon Tubbs with us to talk about her new book for the next few minutes. Sharon Tubbs, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much, Greg. I appreciate that summary. I am delighted to be here with you this morning.
So we are talking about something that occurred to your grandfather, Israel, a long time ago. I mean, more than 60 years ago. And it was something important and yet something that was very, very seldom spoken about. And that's, of course, what set you on the mission of trying to discover more about what exactly happened to your dad, your grandfather. First of all, take us back to your grandfather, whom you never knew very well at all while he was alive. At one point in your book, you say, I didn't really know my grandfather until after he died, which is kind of an interesting way to put it. But describe who your grandfather was, Israel Page, and then take us to what engulfed him at one point and which led ultimately to this ugly incident in early 1959.
So my grandfather, Israel Page, was a sharecropper, a pastor, as you mentioned, and a well driller in an area called Browns, Alabama, in the 1950s. He was the husband of a woman that we call Big Mama, Margaret Page, and the father of 13 siblings, as well as having he and Margaret raised grandchildren as well. And so at this time in 1950s Alabama, he was born in 1908, But during 1950s Alabama, he had all of these jobs, and he was, you know, just a simple man living life as best as an African-American could in rural Alabama during the Jim Crow era. And he got into a car accident on Highway 80, a major thoroughfare in Alabama, in 1954. And he was broadsided by a sheriff deputy from another county, from Talladega County. And he was injured during this car crash. The passengers in the sheriff's car were only mildly injured. I think one of them got a broken leg and then walked away. My grandfather, however, lost the use of his right arm. And so after that, he could no longer perform as a well driller for Radford & Sons Water Wells down in Alabama. And that was the main source of income. As you can imagine, preachers during that time, especially black preachers, didn't make a lot of money from the tithes and offerings and those types of things. And sharecropping was not profitable for black people during that time because the owners of the land took most of the profits. So he no longer could support the family, did not receive damages from the sheriff or the sheriff's department in 1954. So by 1955, he filed a civil lawsuit. He got a lawyer and filed a lawsuit to recoup some of the damages. He lost his car and, again, the use of his arm, so he lost his livelihood. The case wound through the system for 3.5 years until 1959. He was definitely a shoo-in to win the case because the Highway Patrol had faulted the sheriff's deputy in the accident, and the deputy had pleaded guilty and paid a fine for running a stop sign, which caused him to broadside my grandfather. And so he was a shoo-in to win the case, but the night before, or the day before, rather, two white men posing as preachers came to the house and engaged him in conversation, ultimately convinced him to go to the car where other men awaited, and kidnapped him and took him to a wooded area and beat him, as you said, severely.
One point that you make in the book at some point is that your father had reason to be at least somewhat confident that the legal pursuit of justice in terms of this accident, that he might be successful. And that has something to do with something that many people will know, Brown versus the Board of Education. Tell us about the connection between that landmark Supreme Court case and your father's story and how he viewed this pursuit of justice differently than he might otherwise.
Yes. So my grandfather, like you said, had definite reason to be hopeful, we should say. I believe because of the signs of the times at that period, Brown v. Board of Education had just been decided by the Supreme Court in 1954, I believe a month or two, I'm remembering correctly, before my grandfather's accident had occurred. And so there seemed to be a wave of opportunity that was opening for black people at the time. Also in 1954, Martin Luther King was just emerging in Montgomery, Alabama. And if you'll recall, the Montgomery bus boycott began later on that year and went on into 1955. And so this was a time where the civil rights movement was not in full swing, definitely, but black people were rising up to speak their voice during this time. And so my grandfather, although he only had a third grade education, was one who definitely was a reader. One of his brothers or several of his brothers called him Book. And so he was one who would read and always listen to the news on the radio in the morning. So he knew the things that were happening in the environment around him. And so I believe that wave of uprising, that initial wave of uprising of the civil rights movement, gave him hope. Also, as we said, he was a preacher. He was a pastor. And so that faith that, okay, now I see these signs, and God can, you know, certainly propel this movement forward and perhaps use him in the midst of it.
Hmm. Of course, you have already outlined for us what happened to your grandfather with this savage attack on him in mid-January 1959. And so his pursuit of justice was, in a sense, stopped in its tracks. We fast forward many decades and to your decision to try to find out more about this. Before we get into that, tell us more about the place that your grandfather's experience had within your family. The impression we get is that this was something that most of you knew a little something about, and yet it was something just never talked about. Tell us more about that. I mean, about growing up, how much did you know about this? How did you know about it? And to what extent was it just one of those subjects that simply could not be broached?
Yes. The first mention that I had heard of it, I was in elementary school, and it was just by happenstance. I was sitting on the couch with my mother, and we were watching the news, the local news, in Fort Wayne, Indiana at this time, because that's where several of my grandfather's children migrated, you know, during the period of the Great Migration, where African Americans moved from the South to the North, the Midwest, and the West. And so we were in Indiana by this time. I was watching the local news with my mother, and a story appeared about the Klan, the Ku Klux Klan, actually getting a permit or applying for one to march in some other area of Indiana. And at this point, I looked at my mom very surprised, because I went to an integrated school. I was bused to an integrated school. I liked my white teachers and principal and had friends there of different ethnic groups. And I was surprised that this hate group that I'd seen in you know, documentaries still existed. And I questioned her about it. And she said, yes, indeed, they do exist. In fact, they got daddy. And so that is where the title of the book came from, because it was the first mention that I had heard that anything had happened to my grandfather. As you alluded to earlier, in my younger years, you know, before my grandfather's death, he had dementia and was I just never really got to know him at all. I saw that he had a lame arm. I didn't know why. And in my small childhood mind, I was kind of afraid of getting close to him or talking to him in any way when the family visited Alabama during those times. And so that was my first knowledge that anything had occurred. By this time, my mother, who had been a young teen during this era, didn't know much about it. She couldn't remember the details, nor could my uncles, most of my uncles and aunts. One of them did, or two of them did, and that kind of broke open the case for me to kind of, you know, begin my research more in depth. But they didn't remember, for instance, the deputy's name or, you know, what exactly happened and anything about the lawsuit. And so that is how, those are the tidbits that were dropped that allowed me to pick those up and run forward with research. So a lot of my cousins still didn't know until this book was written, and I'd written a newspaper article about this a couple of years ago. They had no clue, my generation, that anything like this had happened. So it wasn't something that we talked about at family reunions. Our family, you know, got together at least once a year at family reunions, and had a great time, had dinner and dancing, but no one mentioned this. And as you can imagine, we talked, you know, funny stories about uncles and aunts, but this wasn't something that people brought up because of the pain that it caused. It lingered. That pain and trauma lingered through the generations. Even though it was not talked about, it definitely salted the older generation's views of white America, of living in the United States, of fairness and justice for African Americans, and that then was passed down to us.
This is a book that is about, at least in part, this notion of cultural trauma. Would you tell us at one point is when members of a group endure something horrendous that scars their group's consciousness and changes their identity, and in particular, as you were just touching on, it really changes the way in which that group views the world around them. At one point, I think you put it really, really well when you talk about an element of mistrust that is baked into the black community. I mean, when we think about things like this that occur, that is one of the effects beyond those who are immediately impacted, is this mm-hmm. baking of mistrust. And I should think, although you maybe had some awareness of that before, as you began exploring this experience of your family, surely you came to understand that in all kinds of more vivid ways.
Indeed. Again, if you think about what happened to my grandfather, the perpetrator was not a criminal on the loose, or some vagrant or anything like that. The perpetrator was a sheriff's deputy held in high acclaim in the county in which he worked. So this sheriff's deputy is on assignment. He was on duty at the time, taking what they called an insane, quote, Negro, unquote, to an insane asylum in Mount Vernon. And on the way, he broadsides a black man and pays his fine to the court for running the stop sign, but then does not pay his debt to the man that he injured. In fact, a part of the book, which was a revelation to me and many others, one of the passengers in the car with the sheriff's deputy was compensated for his broken leg, but not my grandfather. And so you can see how that type of, for lack of a better term, dirty deed, the dirtiness of what happened could taint how we would see justice in America for generations to come. And then you begin to see, I had never connected the violence that, you know, police officers have, been accused of and have been found guilty, like the George Floyd, the Breonna Taylor cases, was something that happened in my family. But then as I'm researching this, it dawned on me, we experienced that type of violence as well at the hand of men of the law.
One of the consequences of this seems to have been the dispersal of your family in different places, that at least many members of your family left the South, one might say fled the South, in search of better opportunities and a place where they might be treated fairly. Your book includes a really poignant, sad exchange between your grandfather and I think an uncle of yours who was about to head north. And your grandfather held out very little hope for this uncle of yours that there was any possibility of him of finding fairness anywhere. And of course, one can understand why he might view the world through that kind of lens. Tell us more about your family and this part of their story.
So even after the beating, my older uncles, who were still living at home at the time, held out hope for justice. like I said, there was this wave going on with the civil rights movement, and they really wanted their father to prevail. And plus, they needed the money to support themselves. They had, because of this, the family had to then get on welfare. And so they wanted the father to prevail. They had hope because my grandfather was well-liked in that community. He was known as, quote-unquote, a good Negro, well-liked by white residents. He drilled many of their wells and worked for one of the only well companies there. And so one of the landowners who owned a piece of, not the land that they lived on at the time, but he was a well-known landowner and a prestigious politician, a Democrat in the community at the time, comes to the home, Mr. Coleman Long. He came to the home, and as he was approaching, there was hope that he would help my grandfather to prevail and find out who did this to him. But it was disappointing. My Uncle Willie James was listening in and heard the man basically tell my grandfather that, yes, he could find out who did this, who was behind it, but he didn't want to. He wouldn't, because who knows who was behind it. The Klan at that time was very prevalent in the community. They wore their outfits, at their costumes at night. And so this man was afraid that someone prestigious was involved and didn't want this person to be exposed, didn't want to be involved with exposing him. And so my uncle, after that, saw that although there could be friends of black people, they were not truly allies. They were not the kind of people who would stand up for justice. And so he became so disgusted that he decided at that moment that he was going to leave the South and pursue an area up north where a black man could be a man and truly care for his family. And he was the first sibling to move to Fort Wayne, Indiana. After him, another uncle came, and then they brought my mom up, and then younger ones came after that. And others, you know, lived in New York, Buffalo, New York. I had a couple of aunts in Birmingham who stayed in the South Birmingham, but most moved north away from the South.
Hmm. Much of your book involves your quest to seek out information, to learn more about what exactly had happened to your grandfather. Just try to put into words what a challenge this was. First of all, to try to gain new understanding about something that happened more than a half century ago, but also in terms of needing the cooperation of various people in order to uncover the information you were so desperate to find.
You know, the first challenge was actually talking to my uncles and aunts and my grandmother, who was alive at that time when I first started, about this. It wasn't something, like I said, that they wanted to talk about. So it was awkward calling them and trying to broach this subject. A couple of them did not want to talk about it at all. And so, you know, I couldn't talk to them. So I had to conduct these interviews, so to speak, of my relatives. So that was the first hurdle. And then, of course, finding documentation to back up what they were saying. Much of it I did find. I was able to find by going to Selma, going through court records, going to the library in Selma. And now a lot of those things, those records are digitized. And so I could go to, we have a fabulous library in Fort Wayne, a genealogy section that I could go to and find some of those records. But at the time, you know, just finding documentation to back up what they had said, interviewing people who were around contemporaneously. I did find the son of my grandfather's boss, and he remembered my grandfather, so that was a real joy. But there were others who would not talk to me. The son of my grandfather's attorney did not want to talk about it, and later on I kind of got a whiff of why, because of the racism, even with people who you know, helped blacks to some extent, may not have been true allies. And so couldn't talk to him, didn't talk to others, you know, put out a lot of feelers, but couldn't find a lot of people, especially white people, who would talk about what happened at that time.
Hmm. So ultimately, although I think you are glad you made the attempt, you certainly did not learn all that you would want to learn. And that is part of the story as well of a system not fully responsive to your needs and wishes. As you look back over this experience, what are the most important lessons you've taken away from it?
I think for me, you know, one of the important messages is healing. And finding that healing in knowing your family's story. I initiated this project to find out what happened with my grandfather. In the midst of it, I began to connect some of the microaggressions and things that I experienced and our family's, you know, experiences with what happened to him, like you said, more than 60 years ago. And so those experiences of my own came into greater context, and I remember, you know, actually forgiving myself while I was writing this, forgiving myself for not standing up, you know, confidently in the face of a Klansman. I had been assigned to cover a Klan march, ironically, in the 1990s as a young reporter. And I went up to the Klansman to get his side of the story, which was my duty. But I was very, very nervous. And he saw that and smirked. And I felt so embarrassed that I never mentioned that incident to anyone until after I began to write this. And somehow my grandfather's story and what he endured allowed me the grace to say it was okay to feel that fear and that nervousness in that moment. And so in touching on and digging into my grandfather's story, it gave my own experiences, my own story, fuller meaning and context. Mm. And so one of the lessons that I know we're running out of time, one of the lessons I would say is just knowing your story, talking to your ancestors if you have that opportunity to bring greater context to your own life and story.
As you write at one point, history has a way of revealing life's unseen DNA, the stuff at the
yes.
core of who we are, the marrow of life that fills our souls without us ever sensing it is there. And certainly understanding that in a greater way is part of the story behind your book, They Got Daddy, One Family's Reckoning with Racism and Faith, published by Indiana University Press, the author Sharon Tubbs. Sharon Tubbs, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show. I was honored to speak with you.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD, I'm Gregory Berg. For part two of today's program, we go to the Morning Show archives for an interview that was recorded and initially broadcast 20 years ago, back in 2003.
We're going to be talking for the next few minutes on the Morning Show about a very thought-provoking book, which examines the relationship between white America and black America and the way in which cultural sharing has gone on in some really perhaps somewhat surprising and unexpected ways, and the way in which, in particular, the black community views some of this crossover and in some respects with a bit of alarm or even resentment. The book I'm talking about is called Everything But the Burden, What White People Are Taking from Black Culture. It is actually a collection of essays that approach this thought from various perspectives, and the book is edited by Greg Tate, who is a longtime staff writer at The Village Voice and has a number of literary works to his credit and some musical credits as well as the musical director of the well-known music ensemble Burnt Sugar. And we have Greg Tate for a few minutes to talk with us about this book called Everything But the Burden. Greg Tate, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You say in the introduction that this is admittedly a peculiar book about a peculiar fascination. Tell us why you were moved to say such a thing about your own book and about the topic it explores.
Well, the origins of the book are kind of peculiar in that the project was actually brought to me by two editors at Broadway, who were both white, who were both fascinated by the emergence of Eminem as a pop culture icon, and also by sightings of like young white kids at their suburban train stops wearing backwards baseball caps and baggy jeans and other forms of hip-hop regalia. And they thought there was a book in this, and I did too, certainly knowing, you know, kind of the history of the imitation of black performance styles in American culture that go all the way back really to the plantation and to minstrelsy and on up through, you know, a little closer to our time, you know, through the impact that, you know, rock and roll had on young Elvis Presley, and that the blues and R&B had on the Rolling Stones and the Beatles and Eric Clapton and so forth. So, you know, what we wanted to look at was kind of how, you know, this whole kind of attraction-repulsion effect that's going on in terms of, you know, the black cultural contribution. I mean, the title comes from my mother, something I always heard her say, that, you know, white people want everything that black people produce but the burden of being black, you know. And
she wrote a poem of the same name,
right? She wrote a poem of the same name, you know. And, you know, it's kind of look at, you know, the book is a way of exploring this whole fascination that takes place inside of a culture of scorn and, you know, racial hatred and bestial treatment and the whole lot of it.
That's what, of course, one of the points which I think is particularly interesting. When someone comes along and emulates certain cultural attributes,
right,
of the black community, do you feel, and the writers who share their thoughts in this book, do you feel that that is being done by people that otherwise feel, as you say, scornfully towards blacks, or isn't it being done by whites who happen not to feel that way?
Well, I think that it's one of those things that you look at in a multidimensional kind of way, because you know, I mean, if people hadn't unearthed some of say Elvis Presley's, you know, somewhat racially inflammatory comments, you know, in his history, I don't think that you know, there would have been quite the ire that some people feel towards Elvis Presley, because in fact, when he first was heard on the radio, he was played on black stations, and a lot of black people thought he was black and were surprised when he showed up at their, you know, in their town theaters to find out that, oh, this is a white guy, you know what I mean? But I mean, black audiences have always embraced white artists who they felt were really, you know, honoring, you know, their influence in a sense by bringing their artistry, you know, to the fore. But, you know, it also took place historically in a time, you know, if we look at, say, blues and rock and roll, it takes place in a time when, you know, black artists were really excluded from having the same opportunities in the marketplace that some of their, you know, kind of white inheritors had.
In your introduction, you quote someone, I can't remember now who it is, who posed the question, I think some time ago, but maybe you think the question is still worth asking, okay, why does everyone love black music, but nobody loves black people?
Right.
Who was that who posed that question?
It's actually a performance artist by the name of Roger Guinevere Smith, and he actually did a performance called Huey Newton for PBS that Spike Lee shot, you know, where he told the Huey Newton story, but in an earlier work, he had posed that question, and it always stuck with me because I think it kind of succinctly summed up, you know, some of the paradox that we're talking about today.
Right. You say elsewhere in the introduction of the book that this is a book about black resentment and discontent, to no small extent.
And envy.
Right.
Right.
Now, one of the things I want to try to get a better handle of, because I have read the book to some extent, but not really digested it to the extent that I want to, are your various writers whose essays are collected here, do they, by and large, write from a perspective of resentment, or are they writing about others in the black community who resent this, what's called in some places, white piracy?
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, as you go through the book, you see that it takes a lot of kind of left turns and odd angles in terms of looking at it. You know,
that's my sense, yeah.
Yeah, because some people write very personally. There's an incredible memoir in the book by a young writer named Cassandra Lane. It's called Skinned, where, you know, she talks about growing up in Louisiana. And, you know, Cassandra's a young woman, I mean, in her late 20s, you know. So, I mean, the experience she's talking about is really from the late 70s, early 80s. But it's the experience of having white playmates up until a certain point when their parents decided that she wasn't good enough to play with their children anymore. You know what I mean? And, you know, she deals with, like, the hurt, you know, and resentment that this kind of provoked in her towards white women. And, you know, the book, in the essay, she talks about how she realizes that she has a problem with black men being attracted to white women because of this childhood experience. You know, so that's like one very kind of raw personal response, you know, to the thematic of the book. And then, you know, the other people who look at things in a much more academic kind of fashion, you know, almost. I mean, there's a woman named Renee Green in the book who really looks at the way race is represented in science fiction films, you know, and she spends a lot of time talking about a film with Charlton Heston called The Omega Man.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, and she talks about also the novels of the black science fiction writer, Octavia Butler, you know, and how she deals with the slave experience in a science fictional kind of context, you know what I mean? But, you know, it's an attempt to really kind of look at this thing as broadly as possible in terms of the African-American response, you know. And so, I mean, writers emotionally are coming from a lot of different places. You know, and I mean, Carl Hancock Rux's piece on Eminem, on one hand, you think it's maybe coming from this place of resentment, but what he's really talking about is how the need for black people to actually perform a stereotype of black culture is an oppressing thing in and of itself. The fact that black people have adopted this as an option in terms of how to respond to a, you know, a racist context is a limiting thing in and of itself. So, you know, the writers take you on a lot of journeys in these essays.
Right.
You know, and it definitely take you a lot of places that, you know, I wasn't even expecting to go as an editor.
I suppose one of the parallels that maybe we could draw about this would be that it is perceived by some that taking on a like of black music and adopting certain black fashion styles and so on, and yet not necessarily embracing any blacks as friends,
right,
would be a little bit the same as if someone didn't mind their son playing with blacks on a basketball team,
sure,
but would really have a problem if he tried to bring them home with him, or if one of them wanted to date his daughter or something like that, that somehow that would cross a line. Is that a fair parallel?
I think so. I mean, I think that the mythology and the pathology that's developed around race in American culture and the denial of, you know, the history of slavery, you know, that has gone on as well, has got a lot of things twisted in a lot of people's mind about what's what in terms of, you know, cultural identity and cultural authenticity and cultural sharing and so forth. You know, I mean, I think a lot of people, you know, black, white, and other ways, have a lot of confusion around their identity as Americans because of the way, how racially skewed, you know, the the environment of the culture is, for one thing. You know, the fact that, you know, it's still such a heavily segregated society, you know, in terms of race, in terms of black and white, in terms of just where people live and how they interact socially.
Right.
You know, I mean, all these things have an impact in terms of perpetuating this mythology. Well, at the same time, I can turn on the television, you know, and go from channel to channel, and within like 2, 3, 4, 5 seconds, there's going to be, you know, a black iconic figure, a black musical reference, you know, a black stylistic nuance, you know, portrayed there. You know, so you have this peculiar, again, to use that word, impression that's left by people being socially segregated, but then at the same time kind of culturally bombarded, you know, with you know, black archetypes and stereotypes.
So it's that's, I suppose, where this resentment comes from, and the fact that at least some blacks would like to, in some ways, maybe sort of hold some of this to themselves.
Well, I mean, I think people have such a broad number of responses to the thing. You know, somebody was asking me, you know, how do black people feel about Eminem? And, you know, I couldn't possibly speak for all black people, but, you know, among my friends, I have some people who are pretty politically militant who love Eminem and other people who can't stand it. You know what I mean? Mm. And it really just depends on, you know, how open-minded the person is to a certain extent. And to what degree, you know, someone is willing to let go of, say, their feelings about racial oppression to accept, you know, someone purely as an artist, you know, regardless of the racial context in which he operates.
Right. I'm reminded of a line of dialogue from an episode of ER with the head of the nurses who is African-American. I can't think of her name now, but... in a conversation with another staffer at the hospital where something has come up and the sense was that this was sort of sparked by maybe latent racism. And the one character who is white says, you know, this was not about race. And this African-American nurse replies, with us, it's always about race.
Right.
It's easy for you to say, but for us, it's always about race. And I suppose that's part of what we're talking about is that mindset that views everything that happens on racial terms.
Well, you know, I mean, it's inevitable. You know what I mean? Because it's, you know, I mean, a Jasper, Texas happens. You know, an Amadou Diallo happens. So, you know. You know, in some senses, you know, that a lot of us kind of drop our guard, and then, you know, these kind of bestial incidents of racial violence occur that have such a pronounced history in terms of racial interaction in American society. But as well, you know, a friend of mine used to say that, you know, to be black in this country is to always affirm something, you know, and what he meant by that was, you know, you have a people who were designated incapable of living with whites and incapable of intellectual development by, you know, one of the founders of the country. I mean, Thomas Jefferson, you know, I mean, who's, you know, some of whose statements on race, I mean, would make, you know, Trent Lott look like a racial progressive.
Yeah.
You know, by comparison.
Right. It's,
you know,
very,
I mean,
striking to read, yeah, some of those Jefferson quotations that you include.
You know, without a doubt. I mean, you know, I mean, his racial paranoia was, you know, in some ways beyond comparison.
And
you know,
for one thing, Jefferson seems to have believed that blacks were incapable of profound thought.
Exactly. You know, and this was even in the face of receiving letters from the great mathematician and engineer and architect Benjamin Banneker and from the great poet and philosopher Phyllis Wheatley, you know, in his own time. You know, I mean, this is someone who, even in the face of contrary evidence, you know, simply couldn't accept that, you know, really, he really felt that black people would be too resentful of whites after the slave experience. You know, it's this incredible projection of guilt, you know, and paranoia onto another people,
right,
you know, that really were more a reflection of what was going on in his head, You know what I mean? But, I mean, a lot of that has to do, you know, when you know that kind of history, you know what I mean, and you know that, you know, some of the most offensive ideas about race come from people who are educated, highly placed in the society, highly influential in the society as well.
There are 18 essays in this book, and we are treated to all kinds of different takes on this question,
course, sure.
Including a chapter about Eminem, as you said, a chapter right. about pimps, a chapter about thugs. One particularly fascinating essay, I think, talks about Muhammad Ali and George Foreman
right.
and Norman.
Yeah, Tony Green.
Yeah. Yeah, and the contrast, for instance, between Ali and Foreman, and what that says about different essays. What do we learn from drawing those kind of fascinating comparisons?
Well, I think that, you know, I mean, Tony Green, who wrote that essay, is a writer as well as a former athlete, you know, and he read Norman Mailer's White Negro essay early on, and as he says, you know, some of the things that, you know, Mailer, some of the assumptions he makes about black culture in that book are just outrageous, but he almost feels like somebody had to go there just to break the ice in terms of the way white people read black people and black people's effect on white, you know, on white culture, white society, and so forth. You know, but he also goes on to say that he feels that some of Mailer's writing on boxing, you know, came the closest to anything he'd ever read to the experience of being an athlete on the field. You know, so Tony's coming from a place of great appreciation for Mailer. But, you know, if you see the film When We Were Kings, you know, you see Norman Mailer and George Plimpton in the film kind of going back and forth over the psychology of Muhammad Ali and George Foreman. And it's just, it's almost like hysterical to see, you know, these two literary lions trying to probe inside the psyches of these two black men who have pretty much been sent to Africa to beat each other's brains.
Right.
You know what I mean? And finding that for all their powers of erudition and psychoanalysis, they can't figure out either one of these guys, what they're really about.
Yeah, they don't,
you know,
come,
I mean,
particularly,
like,
close.
Yeah, you know what I mean? And, you know, so in a way, Tony's piece is almost like a send-up of watching these two guys kind of tear their hair out, trying to understand these two black athletes. You know, at the same time, you know, he's just talking about how, you know, as a young black man, he identified more with Foreman than with Ali, you know, because he was a stocky kind of guy, you know, and not that fast on his feet. You know, people made assumptions about him as an athlete, too, you know what I mean? And that's, you know, that's kind of typical of the way this book kind of rings changes, you know, in theme and variation, you know, out of the topic.
Right.
You know? And,
We have just a minute or so, but I wanted to get a sense of, did these essays already exist, or did you assemble them?
No, they're, except for the Hilton House piece on Richard Pryor and
yes.
the Mafia Diawara essay about the impact of, you know, soul music on youth in Mali in Africa in the 1970s. They're all original essays.
Very good. And you chose these writers, and
yes.
did you give them their topics, or did you set them free to explore what they wanted to?
I did. For the most part, I gave them their topics. A few rebelled and kind of came back with their own, and then there were, you know, in the piece of the instance of the Cassandra Lane essay, another one of my writers who was her professor, writer Mary Dankwa, who wrote about kind of the impact of Michael Jackson's kind of skin bleaching on black people in Ghana.
Yes.
You know, she had Cassandra Lane send me her essay, and I said, oh, this is great. It's got to be in the book.
Right. It is yeah. It's a fascinating kaleidoscope of various voices and perspectives. The book, again, is called Everything But the Burden, What White People Are Taking from Black Culture. Greg Tate has edited it. The book is published by Broadway Books. Greg Tate, really interesting to talk with you and very interesting to read this book. I thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you.
tomorrow on the morning show for the first day of March, the first day of Women's History Month, John Oller, author of American Queen, The Rise and Fall of Kate Chase Sprague. At one point in time, Kate Chase Sprague was arguably the most famous woman in America. The story of her rise to fame and fall from grace tomorrow on the morning show. On Thursday and Friday,